Adams shut the door and pressed the button. Rapp stood rigidly against the wall, his head slowly thumping backward into the wood paneling. He was more pissed than he ought to be, he thought. This was a childish romantic crush, a fleeting hope for something he hadn't felt in so long. It was stupid. With all of the shit that was going on around him, with all of the high stakes, it was a complete waste of time and energy to allow himself to be distracted for even a second by something so utterly juvenile. Somewhere in Rapp's brain, a red stamp crashed down on Anna Reilly's file, and she was banished to a part of his memory that was rarely accessed. It was as simple as that. Compartmentalize and move on. With her out of his mind, Rapp looked at Adams. Adams looked back with a prying expression. What? Asked Rapp, a touch too defensively. Adams kept his basset hound eyes locked on Rapp until his new partner repeated his question. Then Milt licked his upper lip once and said, Don't you think you were a little hard on her? Moving away from the wall, Rapp began to fidget in frustration. She's a non-issue, Milt. We have more important things to worry about.
Are you going to let me in on the secret?
Yep, and it's a doozy. Rapp took the MP-10 and cradled it across his chest as the small elevator reached the first basement. It appears Aziz brought along some guy who specializes in breaking into vaults. Rapp stopped to see if Adams could connect the dots. It didn't take long. The expression on Adams's smooth face went from an inquisitive frown to one of surprise.
That's not good.
Nope. Rapp shook his head. Our job is to find out if Hayes is as safe as we thought. Thinking several steps ahead, Adams plucked the folded blueprints from his vest. The series of sheets were like an unruly road map. Adams opened the documents and shuffled the right one to the top. Shooing Rapp out of the way, he held it up against the wall and said,
This is where it's located.
Rapp looked at the layout of the third basement. Only one way in?
Well, not really. Hold that side for me.
Rapp grabbed one side of the blueprint while Adams held the other with his hand.
There's another way down to the third basement.
Adams touched a spot on the blueprint.
This is the anteroom to the vault. This little rectangle area here. It doesn't make a lot of sense from a strict design and engineering standpoint, but it's one of those things you need to implement into a design when you're trying to add things to a 200-plus-year-old building.
Adams touched another spot on the blueprint.
This is the boiler room where we came in, and this is the hall that I told you led to the bunker.
Adams traced his skinny black finger down the hall, took the left-hand turn, and tapped on a door.
This is one of two ways into the anteroom. It's a 3-inch thick steel door. Over here on this wall of the anteroom is the second door. This is probably the one the president used to enter the bunker.
Why do you say that? Asked Rapp.
Because this door leads up a short staircase to a tunnel that runs all the way under the west wing to where there's a much longer set of stairs that lead all the way up to a hidden door just off of the Oval Office.
Adams pulled another sheet from the back and showed Rapp the location of the tunnel and where it went.
This tunnel used to be the bunker until this new one was completed just this last year. As this tunnel comes over from the west wing, it stops here. At that point, you can either go down this little flight, which empties you into the anteroom, or you can go up a flight of stairs that leads to one of those doors that don't exist.
Rapp liked where this was headed. Where is this fictitious door located? Adams changed places again and tapped a spot.
Right here, just down the hall from where we are right now in the China storage room.
That's perfect.
Not quite. Adams shook his head. These doors that lead to the anteroom are hermetically sealed with rubber gaskets. If we go down through the tunnel, we wouldn't be able to hear or see anything in the anteroom unless we open the door to it, and I doubt you want to do that.
No. Rapp thought about the options for a second.
Yeah, you're probably right. That means they would have had to get through one of these outer doors first to get to the bunker door.
Yep, and this is the door they would have gone through.
Adams changed back to the drawing that showed the layout of the third basement.
This way they only go through one door. If they tried to come in through the tunnel door, that's assuming they could find it to begin with, they would have had to go through an extra door.
That makes sense. Rapp looked at the drawing. So, we have to go down the stairs we used when we came in and hope that a guard isn't posted like he was last night.
I'm afraid so.
Okay. Rapp took his hand off the blueprints. Put those things away, and let's get ready to move out. You know the routine. After he was done putting the blueprints back in order, Adams folded them up and stuffed them inside his black vest. Then, unzipping and turning on the monitor, he pressed the button to open the elevator door. Rapp stood over his shoulder while Adams stuck the tip of the snake under the outer metal door leading to the first basement. The tiny lens gave them a slightly warped view of the hallway looking up from the stark concrete floor. Adams maneuvered the lens all the way to the right and then back to the left. "Looks good," proclaimed Rapp as he stepped back and readied his gun. Adams pulled the snake back with his right hand and coiled it against his hip. Rapp took the doorknob in his right hand, pulled, and scooted quickly into the hallway. He brought his MP-10 up and swept to the left and right. Adams was just two steps behind, having had to pause for just a second to shut the outer door to the elevator. In less than 3 seconds, Rapp was at the door that led to the two lower floors. A twist of the metal knob with his gloved right hand, and he was through the door, his thick black silencer moving everywhere his eyes went. Whether he had one hand on the weapon or two, it made no difference. At these close distances, one-handed, he could hit a head-sized target with about 95% accuracy on the first shot. With both hands on the efficient and compact Heckler & Koch, it was a guaranteed 100%. After checking the stairwell above, Rapp began his controlled descent, keeping his body pressed against the wall, always looking down and checking each new stair as it came into view. Adams followed quietly several steps behind. Rapp was gaining confidence in him. When they hit the landing in between the second and third basements, Rapp stopped. The tiny surveillance unit he had placed next to the door was barely discernible. If he hadn't known it was there, he doubted he would have seen it. Stopping for even 5 seconds out in the open like this seemed like an eternity, but Rapp was trying to get a feel as to whether someone was on the other side of the door. He went down the last 4 steps and stopped, his eyes fixed on the half-inch sliver of light that framed the base of the metal fire door. For another long 5 seconds, Rapp crouched and stared. Still nothing. Rapp waved Adams down. The older man descended the last flight cautiously, holding on to the monitor as if it were the head of a baby. Stepping back and holding his submachine gun ready, Rapp directed Adams to slide the tip of the snake under the door. As Adams moved the device to the left, a pair of boots came into view. They were walking toward the door. Rapp reached out and pulled Adams's hand back, keeping his gun trained on the door. After waiting several seconds for the boots to pass, Adams and Rapp retreated in silence. Brooding might have been the right word, at least at first, but that smug emotion was gone now, replaced by one of self-loathing and personal disgust. Disgust, she told herself. Not disappointment or disrespect. It was disgust. Mr. Secret Agent Man's parting slam had stung, and Anna Reilly's first response had been to fold her arms tightly across her chest and ask herself just who that gun-toting ass thought he was. Where in the hell did he get off judging her so quickly? He didn't know who she was. He was just another one of those arrogant white males like so many of her dad's cop friends who thought they were the only ones that knew what life was all about. They had no idea how important it was to have a truly free press. Just who in the hell did he think he was? The voice in the back of her head responded, "He's the man who risked his life to save yours." At that point, Reilly's mood turned from brooding to self-loathing, and now she sat, feeling not so hot about herself. The elevator stopped at the second door, and without having to be told, Adams was already working the monitor to check the different surveillance units. For his part, Rapp was trying to figure out their next step beyond calling Langley. There had to be a way to check on the president. When they got back in the stash room, he would get Adams to spread out his blueprints and see if there were any other options. But that meant really, and that wouldn't work. She already knew too much, and things were only going to get worse. Adams finished checking the surveillance units and told Rapp the coast was clear. Rapp nodded, and after a couple seconds he said, "When we get back to the stash room, I'm going to need you to step outside with Anna for a couple of minutes while I talk to Langley." The twisted expression on Adams's face gave Rapp the impression he wasn't too fond of the idea. "What's wrong?"
"I don't like the idea of sitting outside of the room with her and my little six-shooter."
The horizontal lines on Adams's shiny black forehead deepened.
"I think you're overreacting."
Adams saw an instantaneous change in Rapp's demeanor. The lid on the kettle started to wobble. In earnest, Adams added,
"Just a bit. I mean, I understand your need for secrecy and everything, but..."
Rapp cut him off. "She's a reporter. End of discussion. Let's go." Rapp jerked his thumb toward the door. It was obvious Rapp wasn't going to budge, so Adams zipped up the monitor and opened the door. Rapp stepped onto the white tile floor first, and Adams closed the door behind them. Another quick trip across the hall, and they were back in the large walk-in closet. Rapp pointed at the ground. "You stay here. Use the monitor to make sure no one is coming. I'll leave the door unlocked. At the first sign of trouble, come back in the room." Rapp didn't give Adams a chance to ask any questions. Turning immediately, he opened the organizer and stepped into the stash room. Reilly was sitting in the corner right where they had left her. Rapp looked down at Anna Reilly and wished she weren't there. Wished he could just erase her from his mind. "You're back awfully quick," was the only thing Reilly could think of. Ignoring her words, he stuck his hand out. Reilly grabbed it, and Rapp pulled her to her feet. He maneuvered her toward the open door and ignored her question. Pushing her out into the closet, Rapp pulled the organizer shut with a slight click. He dropped to one knee, grabbed the handset to the field radio, and said, "Iron Man to control, over." A female voice answered and told Rapp to hold. Less than 10 seconds later, Thomas Stansfield's smooth voice came over the thin plastic receiver.
"What did you find out?"
"I came up dry on the first run, sir. There was a tango in the hallway. We couldn't proceed past the stairwell."
"What level was the tango on?"
This time it was General Campbell's voice. "Third basement." Rapp rubbed his brow with his right hand. "He was positioned just outside the doors for the stairwell and the boiler room." There was a pause, and Rapp imagined a gaggle of military aides shuffling blueprints around and showing the general the exact location.
"Any thoughts on why he would be there?"
It was Stansfield again. Rapp finished kneading the skin on his brow. "Off the top of my head, I can think of two. First, the guy is down there to make sure no one comes through the shaft again. Or second, he's down there to make sure no one interrupts the progress of this Yassin, or whatever his name is." There was the exhaling sigh of thought, and then the words,
"I would concur. Do you or Milt have any ideas on how we might circumvent this guard?"
"Maybe." Rapp began rubbing his forehead again. "Give me about 10 minutes and I'll call you back." Rapp set the handset back in the cradle. Now it was time to grab Milt and figure out a way to verify whether or not the president was safe. What to do with the reporter? Standing, he popped open the door and pushed it outward. Adams and Reilly were standing in the dimly lit closet, talking quietly. Rapp motioned for Adams to join him and then said to Reilly, "You're going to have to stay out here while we talk." Adams stepped forward, grabbing Reilly's arm and bringing her with him.
"She's got something to say to you."
Rapp stood in the opening, reluctant to move, looking at Adams and wondering what in the hell he had said. Looking to Reilly, he saw that her feisty attitude was gone. After a long moment, Rapp retreated a step and allowed the two of them to enter the stash room. Chapter 36. Seals don't like to sit around, especially when there's action to be had, and even more so when one of their own has been killed. Lieutenant Commander Harris wanted a piece of that action, and although he would never admit it to the brass, he wanted to put a bullet in the head of every terrorist in the White House. No prisoners. Now Harris was in the process of exactly that as he strode up the steps of the old post office on the corner of 12th and Pennsylvania. He had walked the 4.5 blocks from his makeshift command post on the east fence of the White House with the bullish Mick Reavers. They were still there, manning the CP, despite the debacle of last night. Rapp and Adams were, after all, still in the building, and the powers that be at the Pentagon had yet to decide on a redeployment, if any. Harris knew that was a distinct possibility. At any minute, he could get the order to pack himself and his men up. The press was asking a lot of questions concerning Aziz's statement that he had turned away an assault. If they pushed hard enough and the politicians started chirping, Six's plug would be pulled. JSOC didn't like operating in the light, and if the current trend continued, they would most certainly pull Harris and his men away from the White House and back undercover. There was one other alternative, but Harris didn't want to think about it. He wanted to believe that the Navy and ultimately the Pentagon would do the right thing, but he knew from past experience that that didn't always turn out to be the case. In a crisis, SOP for the Pentagon often was to circle the wagons and offer up a sacrificial lamb. The beast served to the press was usually the unit commander, and that, of course, was yours truly, Lieutenant Commander Dan Harris. Harris was dressed in his fire-retardant black coveralls. Surprisingly, he and Mick Reavers didn't attract too much attention. By the third day of the crisis, the spectators had grown used to seeing heavily armed men going to and fro in black ninja jumpsuits. The two SEALs had left their submachine guns back at the command post, but both still carried their H&K USP 45 caliber handguns in their thigh holsters. As Harris and Reavers bounded up the steps two at a time, they were met at the top by Charlie Wicker. Wicker turned and opened one of the heavy old doors. Harris and Reavers fell into step behind Wicker, all three men swiveling their heads as they walked into the large old building. Their discerning eyes took an almost instantaneous inventory of all that was around them. Exit signs, windows, strange-looking people, you name it. They did it out of habit. Always know your surroundings. Wicker approached a bank of elevators. The one on the far left was held for them by a security guard. As they stepped into the elevator, Wicker looked at the security guard and said, "Al, this is Lieutenant Commander Harris." The balding man stuck out his hand.
"Al Turley, Commander. Nice to meet you."
"Same here." Harris grabbed Turley's hand and gave him the requisite bone-crushing handshake. Then, pointing to the mound of flesh next to him, he said, "This big fella is Chief Reavers." His hand still stinging from Harris's handshake, Turley decided to skip the nicety with the even larger Reavers. When the elevator reached the top door, Turley led the way down the hall. At the end of the hallway, they came upon a door labeled Bell Tower. Extracting a key, Turley opened the door, and they stepped into a stairwell that appeared to have been built not too long after the Civil War. The narrow staircase was flush against the wall on one side, and on the other was only a railing. They were inside the dingy bell tower of the grand old post office. Turley, not wanting to slow the others down, let them take the lead. He had already taken the wiry little one up to the top once, and he thought his heart might leap from his chest. As Turley expected, the three black-clad men marched up the steps two at a time. Within seconds they were out of his sight, only the echoes of their footsteps letting him know they were above him. Turley slowed his pace.
10 months from retirement, it wasn't worth it.
The three SEALs reached the top without so much as breaking a sweat. Wicker climbed up the ladder that was bolted to the wall, and with one hand he pushed open the hatch that led to the bell tower. Pulling himself up and through, he spun around on his butt and stood. Harris was next, and then Reavers. All three men stood side by side, looking west out the large aperture. The bell tower atop the old post office had the second most commanding view of all Washington after the one from the Washington Monument. From this eagle's nest, they looked straight down Pennsylvania Avenue, past Freedom Plaza and Pershing Park, over the southwest corner of the Treasury Building, and there, perfectly bathed in the bright afternoon light, was the White House. Wicker retrieved a pair of binoculars with a laser rangefinder from his vest and handed it to his CO. After turning his black baseball cap around so the brim was out of the way, Harris held the binoculars up to his eyes. The commander of SEAL Team 6 zeroed in on the roof of the White House and sought out the tiny rooftop guard booth. After a slight adjustment, the blue hue of the bulletproof plexiglass was in the crosshairs. Harris paused for a second and watched the hooded man sitting behind the protective glass. Harris's forefinger pressed a button, and a second later three red numbers appeared. Harris handed the binoculars to Reavers and turned to Wicker. 820 meters? Wicker nodded confidently.
Yep.
What's the forecast for tonight?
A lazy southeasterly breeze between 2 and 5 knots.
Harris nodded. That was child's play for Wicker. He could hit this shot from almost double the distance at 5 knots. What about the glass?
It's 1/2 inch. I've shot through it before on the range.
Wicker continued his confident stare, eyeballing the White House with his naked eye. That's the range. This is real life. We need to know how old that glass is, the manufacturer's testing data, everything we can get our hands on. Wicker kept his eyes on the White House, supremely confident in his skills, knowing that there were only a handful of men in the whole world that matched him in skill and none that could exceed.
The glass was installed in 92 and is due to be replaced within the next year. I studied the manufacturer's testing data 2 years ago and have all the info I need right up here.
Wicker tapped his temple with his forehead.
If that glass was brand new, I could still do it, but it's been baked by the sun now for 7 years. Its strength has been reduced by at least 60%. With 250s, we'll be able to drill right through it.
Wicker nodded confidently and added,
Hell, the first shot might even get him.
Harris was a little surprised that Wicker already had the stats.
How did you find out about the glass?
I called one of my fellow snipers at the Secret Service.
When? Asked Harris.
2 days ago.
Wicker kept his gaze on the White House. Harris smiled. He loved it when his men were proactive.
You've been thinking about this shot for that long?
Wicker turned, a devilish grin spreading across his lips.
I've been thinking about this shot ever since we ran that exercise 8 years ago.
Harris knew the exact exercise Wicker was referring to. It had been on his mind since the onset of this entire clusterfuck. Slowly, Harris began to nod. And then, with a smile of his own, he looked to Wicker and said,
Don't ever tell anybody that. The boys at the Secret Service might not understand your professional curiosity.
Oh, they understand,
Wicker nodded.
We've talked about this shot 100 times.
The boys at the Secret Service that they were referring to were the men of the counter-sniper unit, widely regarded as the best professional shooters from top to bottom in the world. There wasn't a single shot at the Secret Service that could match Wicker under combat conditions, but in a controlled urban environment, they were awesome. Harris looked back at the White House. Snipers were a weird lot, kind of like goaltenders in hockey or pitchers in baseball. They were loners, fiercely independent, and more than a little superstitious.
What do you need to make it happen?
Wicker pulled several pieces of paper from his vest. Unfolding them, he held them up for his CO.
First thing we have to do is build a shooting platform. With the right men and equipment, I can have it ready by sundown.
Harris looked at the drawings.
What about the noise?
Wicker reached over and flipped to the second page.
We place a top over the platform and line it with acoustic foam. We leave a nice narrow slit at the front and we're set. Only about 5% of the report will make its way out of the slit, and that won't travel more than a block, tops.
Harris loved that Wicker was ahead of the game. Handing Wicker the drawing, he slapped him on the back and said,
Good job, Slick. I like it. Make it happen as fast and quiet as you can. Get out of your coveralls and tell the rest of your boys to wear their civvies.
Looking at his watch, he added, I want you operational by 1800. With that, Harris started down the hatch, confident that Wicker would have everything in place by the appointed hour. Now came the hard part. He would have to convince the big boys that an exercise he had participated in 8 years ago would work today. Harris already had the pitch formed. He would keep it as simple as possible and use SEAL Team 6 as the tip of the spear. Delta and HRT would provide the overwhelming force when the time was right. The words weren't going to come easy, at least not at first. Anna Reilly was both a proud and a stubborn person, but she was not, as Rapp thought, an ingrate. Milt Adams had closed the door to the stash room, and Reilly was left facing the man who had saved her life. As Reilly looked at him, she decided she liked him much better when he smiled. In his current serious mood, he looked dangerous. Not just his dark clothes and the various weapons strapped to his lean body, but his chiseled jawline and those dark eyes. The man had an intensity about him that Reilly hadn't noticed before. His tanned, weathered face had the strong lines acquired by a man who does not spend his days in an office. It was the eyes, though, that both drew her in and made her want to shiver. Dark pools of brown. So dark they were almost black. Framed on top by two thick eyebrows. This was the man who was capable of killing. The man who had plunged his knife into her assailant. Reilly's mouth must have been slightly open because it was suddenly void of moisture. She closed it and swallowed hard. Then, opening it slowly, she said, I'm sorry for the way I handled that situation earlier. I don't want to seem like I'm... She paused, struggling to get the next word out. Ungrateful. Reilly had to look down. It was difficult to look into those dark eyes and make the apology. I'm not crazy about signing anything, especially something the government wants me to sign. Reilly looked up and made a half-hearted effort at a smile, but the dark orbs on Rapp's face turned her gaze back down. I realize this thing is a lot bigger than me, and if there is anything I can do to help save the rest of the hostages, I'm more than willing to do my part. As far as what happens when this is over, if you wish to remain anonymous, I will honor that. If you feel, or whoever you work for feels, that you need to edit my story before I tell it, Reilly was forced to pause again, feeling very uncomfortable with this particular concession. Still looking at the ground, she said, If you really feel the need to edit out material that you are absolutely sure is too sensitive to report, I'll go along. I'll probably do it kicking and screaming, but I'll do it. Rapp was conflicted. His opinion of the young and attractive Ms. Reilly had already been etched into his mind and filed away. Now it appeared he might have been mistaken. She had been wrong, but now she was correcting that, taking a big step to humble herself and admit it. The ball was back in Rapp's court. Chapter 37 Her elbows rested heavily on the table. The hum of computers, faxes, scanners, and monitors droned in the background. The control room at Langley was in the midst of a lull. Kennedy's hand cupped her chin and her eyes were closed. Opening her eyes, she looked at the red digital clock on the wall. It was almost 12:30. She let out a yawn and stretched her arms above her head. Things were about to happen. She had felt it herself and seen it in the look Thomas Stansfield had given her. The light on her phone blinked once and then began to ring. She grabbed the handset and answered. Dr. Kennedy. Irene, it's Jane. I've been busy trying to get an answer to your question, but things have proved a little more difficult than I thought. How so? Well, the subject is not entirely with us. Kennedy frowned. Will he be coming back? No. There was a substantial pause, and then, at least, I don't think so. Then, in a slightly defensive tone, Dr. Hornig added, You must remember this is all new, very cutting-edge stuff. Did you get anything out of him? From what little I could gather.
Harut had no idea what this Yasin fellow's talents were. But please keep in mind he's not all there.
Irene didn't want to hear excuses. She wanted answers.
Did you get anything out of him?
I'm afraid not.
Okay. If you find anything out, please let me know. Kennedy disconnected the call and dialed an international number. While the secure satellite technology at Langley started the process, Kennedy turned around and checked to see what her boss was doing. Thomas Stansfield sat comfortably in his chair while Jonathan Brown, the deputy director of Central Intelligence, relayed a slew of congressional complaints and inquiries. From what little Kennedy heard, she gathered that the congressmen and senators on the Hill were demanding to know what in the hell happened last night. The familiar voice of Colonel Fine answered on the other end, and Kennedy turned around.
Ben, it's Irene. Have you found anything out on Yasin?
Nothing firm. Some rumblings and rumors here and there, but we haven't been able to nail him down.
Which one are we talking about? The Iraqi or the Palestinian?
I have heard nothing back about the Iraqi, but I have several sources who are claiming they have seen the 18-year-old Palestinian within the last 4 days.
Pondered Kennedy.
Let me caution you, though. We have not been able to track him down.
I know, but we are definitely leaning closer to one than the other.
My contacts in Iraq are not as deep, Irene. The man could be there, but I need more time to track him down.
Kennedy looked back at Stansfield and let him know that she needed to talk to him. Into the phone, she said,
Ben, I have to run. Thank you for the info, and please let me know the second you find out anything else.
Before you go, said Fine loudly, I have something I wish to discuss.
Fine paused and then continued.
There are people in my government who are threatening to tear apart the entire peace accord if your country persists with this position of negotiation. We have a very good idea what Aziz's last demand will be, and we are prepared to occupy the territories with troops if it comes to that.
Kennedy stopped everything she was doing. She dissected the colonel's words carefully. Israel was prepared to go to war.
Has your ambassador been informed of this?
I do not know.
Has your prime minister informed our vice president?
I do not know.
Kennedy paused momentarily. Ben, Director Stansfield has the interests of Israel very high on his list, but he is only one man. Now is not a time to play games through back channels. I would suggest that certain people in your government start banging the drum and bang it loudly. They know who to talk to.
Kennedy stopped for a moment and added, Don't worry about your support from Langley. We have never wavered on this issue and are not about to.
There was a moment of silence and then,
Good. I will pass that along.
And I appreciate the information, Ben. Please let me know the second you find anything more.
Kennedy hung up the phone and swiveled her chair around. Brown was still talking to Stansfield. Kennedy was not sure about the new deputy director. It wasn't due to a lack of confidence in his skills. He was intelligent and professional. Her issue with Brown lay more in where his bread was buttered. Brown was not an insider at Langley. He had been with the agency for less than a year. In his early 50s, he was a former federal prosecutor and judge who, after leaving the bench, went to work for one of Washington's poshest law firms, making close to $1 million a year. After pressing the flesh with all of the bigwigs in Congress for a half dozen years, he had obtained a nomination for the deputy director slot and was confirmed. It was a safe bet that his allegiance was more with the senators who had confirmed him than with the man he was now talking to. It was that simple fact that kept Kennedy from speaking in front of the man. She waited for several minutes until Brown left, then rose and approached the elevated desk behind her. Stansfield leaned forward and asked,
What is it?
General Flood also leaned forward, sensing that Kennedy might have obtained a valuable piece of information.
I just spoke to Colonel Fine. He's gotten nowhere in terms of the Yasin from Iraq, and with the young Palestinian, they have several contacts who have claimed to have seen him in the last 4 days.
Flood shook his head and said,
"That's it, Thomas. We have to tell him."
Stansfield's face remained passive, and Flood persisted.
"It's our duty. Iron Man hasn't come up with anything definitive, but it sure does look like something is going on down in that basement. Aziz doesn't have enough men to tie up one of them down there."
"What about the ventilation duct?" asked Kennedy. "Maybe he's afraid we'll try and use it again."
"Bullshit," grumbled Flood. "All he has to do is booby-trap the only stairwell that leads up from the basement, and he has us boxed in."
Kennedy agreed.
Flood leaned toward Stansfield and said, "We have to tell him, Thomas. We should have told him this morning."
Stansfield looked at the large general. He knew Flood was right, but also knew how Vice President Baxter would react. He would wiggle. He would question the validity of their conclusion. He would put off making any decision until he absolutely had to. Despite all of that, Flood was right. They had to tell him.
Dallas King sat across from his boss and watched him talk on the phone. The afternoon sun spilled through the windows of the vice president's study at the Naval Observatory. King was still obsessing over his role in aiding the terrorists. He had decided only one thing thus far, that he would keep his mouth shut. There wasn't a snowball's chance in hell that he would volunteer what he had done to the FBI. It would do no good. They couldn't turn back the clocks. What he had to do right now was damage control. Who else knew about the late-night excursion? There were the two women, of course, but they were bombed. There was Joe, the Secret Service officer who had let them in. King thought about checking up on Joe, but that might make things look worse if the story came out. No. For now, he would sit and do nothing and hope that no one would ever link him to the terrorist. Aides shuffled in and out of the room on an almost continuous basis. The large dining room and living room of the mansion had been converted into offices for Baxter's support staff, and the dozen or so essential personnel who had been displaced when the old executive office building had been shut down by the Secret Service. It was one of those essential aides who quietly entered the room and approached King. In a voice low enough to not distract the vice president, she said,
"Director Stansfield and General Flood are on the line, and they wish to speak to the vice president immediately."
King stood. "Which line?" The young woman held up two fingers and began her retreat. King watched her leave. Out of habit, he checked out her backside as she sauntered for the door. It was nice. He'd been eyeballing her for the better part of the new year, but knew it would be trouble. Office romances were a big no-no. Stick with the married women, King told himself. King made his way over to a credenza on the other side of the large study. After running a hand through his hair and checking himself out in an ornate gilt-framed mirror, King grabbed the receiver from the phone and stabbed the blinking red button.
"Director Stansfield, General Flood, Dallas King here."
It was Flood who spoke first.
"Dallas, where is the vice president?"
"He's right here, but he's on the line with the Secretary General of the UN.
"Well, tell him we need to speak with him."
Flood's voice was even gruffer than normal. King held the receiver to his left ear, and with his right forefinger he smoothed out his eyebrows. Looking into the mirror to check on his grooming, he replied,
"As I said, he's on the line with the Secretary General, and it's rather important. Is there something I can help you with?"
Flood, the highest-ranking officer in the entire United States military, was used to people jumping to his requests. Add to this the tense situation and a lack of sleep, and the result was predictable.
"God damn it," bellowed Flood. "You've got some things to learn about the chain of command, son. When the chairman of the Joint Chiefs calls and says he wants to talk to the vice president, you put him on the phone."
King pulled the receiver away from his face and looked at it with a frown. Under his breath, he said, "Give me a break." Then into the phone, he replied,
"Let me see if he can take your call."
Without waiting to see if it was okay, King pressed the hold button and set the phone down. Looking into the mirror one more time, he straightened his tie and checked his perfect white teeth. Walking across the spacious study, he approached the vice president's desk and gave his boss the proper signal. Baxter looked up, and when the moment was right, he said,
"Excuse me, Mr. Secretary, would you hold one moment, please?"
Baxter covered the phone. What now?
General Flood and Director Stansfield are on line two, and they want to talk to you immediately.
Immediately, Baxter repeated the word in the same tone as King.
Yep, General Flood has got his undies in a bind about something. He snapped at me when I told him you were busy.
Baxter took his hand off the receiver and said, Mr. Secretary, I want to continue this conversation, but I must take an urgent call. May I call you back in a few minutes?
Baxter nodded several times while he listened to the Secretary General of the UN and then said,
Thank you.
King looked down at his boss and said, I think I'd better listen in on this.
Baxter nodded his consent, and King quickly crossed the room and stood poised above the phone on the credenza. When his boss reached down to punch the proper line, King did the same. Baxter said, Hello, General Flood.
Mr. Vice President, I'm on the line with Director Stansfield. We've come across some troubling information that we must bring to your attention.
In less than a minute, Flood brought Baxter up to speed on what was going on in regard to Mustafa Yassin and the information provided by the Israelis and CIA. Dallas King watched his boss silently from across the room. He listened to Flood, and in some twisted way the news excited him. King knew it shouldn't, but this was real high drama, and he was one of just a few who were privy to this jarring information. The president was not as safe as they had thought. General Flood moved from stating the facts into stating his case, and he did so with two sentences.
Mr. Vice President, under no circumstances can we allow the president to fall into the hands of these terrorists. Delta Force and HRT are ready to retake the White House on your order.
Vice President Baxter let out the moan of a man who could take no more bad news. And then, after a moment or so of fidgeting, he asked,
How can we be sure? Aziz has said nothing about the president in any of his demands.
We can't be sure, answered Flood. But we sure as hell can't take the risk of letting the president become a hostage.
What if this information is wrong?
Baxter looked up at King.
We still have quite a few hostages in there, and from what you've told me, the odds of them surviving a takedown are not good.
Sir, at this point I see no other alternative. We cannot, under any circumstances, allow Rafiq Aziz to get his hands on President Hayes.
There was a long pause while Baxter looked up at King. Finally, he sighed into the phone and asked,
What is it that you want from me, General Flood?
I want you to do what's right. I want you to give me the green light to retake the White House.
King was shaking his head vigorously at his boss. No one was going to commit to anything until he and the Vice President had a chance to discuss it. Vice President Baxter looked up at King and nodded. Then into the phone he said,
General, this information seems a little thin to me. As I've already said, you have full authority to move your people into position and to collect intelligence just so long as you don't endanger the lives of the hostages. But I want to make myself clear on this once again. I am the only person who will authorize the takedown of the White House.
Baxter straightened up in his chair.
Am I clear on this?
Yes, you are, sir, answered a frustrated Flood. That has never been in doubt. That's not what's at issue here. What is at issue is the safety of the President of the United States.
In a firm voice, Flood added,
I am asking you for the authorization to take back the White House. I am asking you to prevent President Hayes from falling into the hands of Rafiq Aziz.
In a soft voice, Baxter answered, General, this is not an easy decision. I need some time to think about it.
But sir, snapped Flood, we might not have the time.
Baxter shot back.
I am running the show here, General Flood, and I will decide how much time we may or may not have. Now, I would suggest that while I'm consulting with my aides, you try and find out if this threat to President Hayes is real or imagined. I mean, for Christ's sake, 2 days ago your own people stood up and told me he could last a month in that bunker.
Baxter shook his head. Barely able to restrain himself, Flood looked to Stansfield for some support. The director of the CIA simply shook his head. Into the phone, the general asked,
What do you want me to do, sir?
I want you to keep me informed and make sure you do nothing to precipitate any more violence from Aziz.
Yes, sir.
With that, the conversation was over. General Flood had hung up without waiting to see if Baxter had anything to add. Dallas King put the handset back in its cradle and walked toward his sullen-faced boss.
You handled that perfectly.
When King reached the desk, he added, Off the top of my head, we have several things working in our favor.
First, this information they have sounds a little thin to me. I mean, we can't trust the Israelis for shit right now. They'd just as soon see us nuke the place. And secondly,
King tapped his chin with his finger,
there's an angle here. Is the president's life more valuable than 50 of his fellow countrymen?
There's an awfully strong argument to be made against the imperial presidency.
No one American life is greater than any other single American life.
Baxter frowned and said, Come on, Dallas. Who's going to buy that load of crap?
Your average Joe, that's who.
King pointed his finger at his boss.
Even if what Flood says is true, which I doubt, since those guys can't seem to find their ass with both hands, that doesn't mean we need to storm the place. With the exception of Marge's big fuck-up, this Aziz guy has been pretty reasonable. So far he hasn't asked for anything that we can't go back and fix later. And the polls tell us, with the exception of a bunch of right-wing extremists, the American people want to see this thing resolved peacefully. Our job here is to continue to walk this fine line, Sherman. If they can't give you solid proof that the president is in imminent danger, I wouldn't budge an inch. We'll get these UN resolutions passed by the end of the day, and in the morning Aziz will release the next group of hostages. That's two-thirds you will have saved.
King stopped and looked out the window. A thought had just occurred to him. Maybe he was cheering for the wrong results. If the terrorists were killed, most of his problem would be solved.
Dallas, what are you thinking? Baxter asked.
King shook his head and turned his attention back to his boss.
Nothing. I was just trying to figure something out.
Jack Warch was on his fourth set of crunches, the modern-day version of the much-hated sit-up. He had considered skipping his daily regimen, but decided he had nothing better to do. Warch did 400 crunches every day of the week except Sunday, and on alternate days he threw in 200 push-ups, a 3-to-5-mile jog, and some stretching. He had it down to a science, which allowed him to stay in shape without spending hours at the gym. As Warch finished his crunches, he eyed the pile of weapons sitting on the table across the room. The sight was irritating. All of that hardware in a room full of the best-trained bodyguards in the world, and the president wanted them to surrender. It was ingrained in Warch's psyche to win, not to lose. Coming from the old Vince Lombardi school of, show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser, Warch couldn't stand the thought of them raising their hands in surrender. He had risen to the most coveted post in the Secret Service by sheer, dogged determination, and he was sure now there had to be a better alternative than surrendering. That's when it hit him with three more crunches to go. Warch stopped, hands firmly clasped behind his neck, staring at the mound of black steel on the table. Some of the most accurate and lethal firepower made, and 9 highly trained individuals. Warch's mind started to scramble. He saw a crack, a slight opening, a way to pull off a Hail Mary. Jumping to his feet, he almost blurted out his idea, but forced himself to sit down on his bunk and think things through thoroughly. He had to have this planned. He had to be able to head off all objections and sell it to the president. Chapter 38. Stansfield allowed General Flood to blow off some steam. As Flood paced back and forth in front of his desk, Stansfield nodded from time to time in an effort to let Flood know he agreed with him. The elderly director of Central Intelligence had expected Baxter's unwillingness to give them the green light, and in his usual analytical way, Stansfield was already looking 3 moves ahead. He could have forewarned the general how Baxter would respond, but felt an angry General Flood would be better than a calm one. Things were coming to a head, and some decisions needed to be made. Now would come the hard part. Stansfield knew Vice President Baxter would never pull the trigger. In his opinion, they should never have started down this road to begin with, but now they had to do something before it got worse. Baxter was maneuvering, trying to buy as much time as possible. The fact that he was doing it during a crisis with such far-reaching implications was almost unimaginable to Stansfield, and that was making his difficult decision much easier. Thomas Stansfield was contemplating doing something that he had done only one other time in the 50-plus years he had served his country. It was something that could end his career in public disgrace, but he was willing to take that chance. He still had his ace in the hole, and now was the time to use it. General Flood looked like a football coach chewing out his team at halftime. Stansfield watched him walk back and forth, shaking his fist and letting a stream of expletives flow from his mouth. Stansfield stayed quiet, letting him take as much time as needed. Gradually, the expletives became fewer and the pacing slowed. The general approached, looking miffed.
"You sure as hell are taking this well. It's not as if things weren't bad enough, and now we find out the president isn't safe. I mean, for Christ's sake, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that Aziz brought along this guy for this exact purpose. Now we know why he spaced the demands out the way he did. He needed time."
Stansfield nodded and moved in to test the water.
"Yes, but what can we do about it? If Baxter doesn't give us the approval, we are left without recourse."
"There's nothing we can do about it. That idiot's calling the shots, and unless we can find a way to convince him to attack, this will only get worse."
Stansfield thought Flood to be a good soldier. The thought of ordering an attack without the approval of Baxter would not even enter his mind. With Stansfield, it was different. Spies were used to operating under a different set of rules. They were used to looking for creative ways to solve problems. Stansfield was not entirely free to do as he wished, but he had significantly more latitude than the general did. Although Stansfield's idea was clearly in violation of the orders Baxter had given him, he had already made up his mind. And he would go it alone. The others had too much to lose. Nearing 80, Stansfield knew the end was not far off. If ever there was a time to stick his neck out, this was it. Looking up at the general with an almost mystical expression, Stansfield said,
"There is one other option."
Flood eyed him with skepticism. He had looked feverishly for a way out and had found none.
"I don't see any way out of this other than hoping Baxter comes to his senses."
"There is one way, and it's right in front of us."
Flood was intrigued.
"Enlighten me."
Stansfield shook his head ever so slightly and said,
"I think it best if you remain in the dark on this one."
Flood's hands moved to his hips, and a strange look washed over his face. He paused, wondering for a moment if he was reading Stansfield correctly.
"What do you have up your sleeve, Thomas?"
Stansfield looked out the large window behind his desk. Without turning back to Flood, the director of the CIA said,
"We both know what needs to be done, General, and there's no sense in risking two when one will suffice."
Slowly looking back over his shoulder, he said,
"I think now would be a good time for you and General Campbell to go visit the front lines. Maybe have a talk with HRT and Delta. See how they're doing. Make sure they're ready to move when the authority is given."
Flood squinted, part of him wanting to know what Thomas Stansfield was up to, but another part of him wanting nothing to do with whatever the director was planning.
"Thomas, what are you up to?"
Stansfield gingerly walked around the desk and placed his thin hand on Flood's substantial biceps. Turning him toward the door, Stansfield started to walk with him.
"I have the best of intentions. Do not worry."
Several steps closer to the door, and he added,
"Just make sure the boys are ready to go when the time comes."
Less than a minute later, they were standing in the control room. Flood had informed Campbell that they were going to visit the troops. HRT would be first, and then Delta. The Ranger assumed it had something to do with the call to Vice President Baxter, and hoped they were about to get the green light. He quickly gathered his things, and on the way out the door held his encrypted cell phone up to Kennedy and reminded her to keep him informed of any changes. After the two generals and several of their aides were gone, Kennedy looked at her boss, who was standing one step above her. Stansfield looked back at her with his tired old eyes.
Did Baxter give you the assault authority?
No, I'm afraid not.
Kennedy's lips pursed.
Why was General Flood in such a hurry to get out of here?
He had some things to take care of.
Stansfield looked at his watch and then asked,
Is Mitch on the line?
Yes.
Stansfield thought it through one last time, making sure he had all of his bases covered. Then, looking around the dark room, he said,
Irene, tell everyone to take a 15-minute break.
Everyone? Questioned Kennedy. He surely didn't mean everyone.
Everyone, stated Stansfield calmly and coolly. I want the room cleared.
Kennedy, cut from the same cloth as her boss, knew the man did not mince or waste his words. She could only assume he had a very good reason for his rather unusual request, and immediately went about the task of clearing the room. Rather than making a boisterous announcement to the entire group, she started with the front row and worked her way to the rear, telling everyone to finish up what they were working on and then head out. No one questioned her. It took just under 2 minutes, and when everyone was gone, Kennedy and Stansfield were left standing alone in the dimly lit room. The wall of monitors at the front of the room cast a blue hue across everything. Stansfield looked down at his protege and said simply,
You too, Irene.
Kennedy was surprised. Her security clearance couldn't get any higher. There was nothing she couldn't hear or view unless it was compartmentalized. She studied her boss intently and wondered what could possibly be going on. Why would he need to be alone in this room? Stansfield stood in front of her like a statue, giving nothing away. Kennedy finally stepped for the door, her mind trying to retrace the steps that led up to this unusual situation. Rapp had awkwardly accepted Anna Reilly's apology. Somewhere in the back of his mind, it registered that asking her to not tell this story was impossible. She would have to tell it to one degree or another, as long as she now accepted the conditions. From the corner, the secure field radio beeped several times, announcing that an encrypted communication was received. Rapp reached over and snatched the handset.
Yep.
Mitchell, it's Thomas. Have you found a way to verify our most recent problem?
Rapp was a little surprised that Stansfield had used his first name.
Maybe. Milt seems to think he might have a way, but it might be hard to pull it off from a logistical standpoint.
There was no immediate reply. After a moment, Stansfield began to speak in a very slow and deliberate voice.
Mitchell, you've sacrificed a lot over the last 10 or so years, and I'm very grateful for that.
There was another pause.
I'm going to ask you to do something, and I don't want you to discuss it with anyone else.
Stansfield stopped again, letting the gravity of his request sink in.
Am I understood?
Yes, sir.
First, we must verify if President Hayes is safe in his bunker. Second, we need to re-establish radio contact with him. All radio and phone traffic from the bunker has been jammed, as you know. Find and disable that unit so I can speak directly to the president.
Rapp clutched the phone. What are my rules of engagement?
I would prefer it if you did it as quietly as possible, but use whatever force you see fit. Just make sure you get the president back online.
The magic words reverberated through Rapp's mind. He was free to do as he saw fit. Now he could really get things done. Almost as quickly as he had begun to celebrate, he saw that something didn't fit.
Does anyone else know about this?
Just you and me.
Rapp closed his eyes. This was unusual.
What about Irene?
No, just the two of us.
So I'll be operating without Annette for a while.
I'm afraid so.
Stansfield wasn't pleased with this, but there was no other way. Rapp nodded while he thought about his lack of backup. "Fuck it," he said to himself. "You're used to working alone."